Welcome to Post Carbon Radio. I'm your co-host, Karin Nyhus, with Bing Gong. Post Carbon Radio covers the climate crisis from a range of perspectives centered on Northern California. Climate change is the ultimate interrelated issue, so we include news and perspectives on clean and dirty energy, the economy, social justice, and even war and peace. We want to both inform and inspire you by connecting you to people, movements, and new ideas about climate change from around the world and right here in West Marin County. Join us on KWMR the second and fourth Mondays of every month at 1 p.m. for Post Carbon Radio. Today we have a special interview for the hour live in studio, and we will be taking calls during the second half of the hour. So please note the phone numbers now. We won't take calls until 1:30, but our numbers are 415-663-8492 and 415-663-8317.
Welcome to Post Carbon Radio. I'm Bing Gong, and our show today is on the climate crisis and cycle analytic work. And in the studio with us, we have Renee Lertzman, a PhD, who is an applied researcher, speaker, instructor, and strategic communication specialist. She has a PhD in social sciences and an MA in communication studies, and resides in Inverness. And her work focuses on the psychological dimensions of climate and environmental engagement and communications. So welcome to the
Post-Carbon Radio. Thank you so much.
And why don't we start off with, tell us a little bit about your focus and of your work.
Okay. Well, thank you. It's actually a great honor to be on this radio show, which I've been listening to and following, so happy to be here. So the focus of my work is really about bringing in insight and resources available through psychological work and practice. So for about 20 years now, I've been deeply interested and involved with what does psychology have to offer our environmental issues and degradation. And it started when I was a student at UC Santa Cruz taking environmental studies courses and feeling completely overwhelmed and a lot of despair and following those courses with classes in social psychology and then following those courses in cultural studies. And so that combination really gave rise to this question, which I'm continuing to explore in my work, is what can we learn from psychology and specifically psychoanalytic psychology and psychotherapeutic psychology? In other words, people who work with people in clinical context primarily. What can that offer those working on the front lines of the environmental movement and advocacy? How can we support our efforts? How can our work be even more effective? How can we leverage, what we know about the human to communicate, engage, and mobilize and all of that better?
So I'd like to start with what I think we know doesn't work and have you tell us why it doesn't work. And that is some of the earliest communications around climate change as a crisis are all about facts and numbers and models and making a rational case that you should believe this is real, it is serious, and, you know, that we should all get busy. What is not working and not correct about the logical, rational, fact-based argumentation model?
Right. Well, that's the million-dollar question right there, and it's a question raised in almost every conversation I have. So basically, the short answer is that we are not rational beings, right? And, you know, we are and we're not. But primarily, not only are we not rational, there's a term in social sciences, the rational actor model. And that model has been basically disproved and deconstructed over the years, which is that we do not act always on what we know, right? So that's the so-called gap between what we know and what we do. Psychoanalytic work takes that further and identifies that even within our own selves, there's conflict. So we can even have, multiple values, multiple beliefs that are in conflict with one another. And so appealing to the – so that's the first piece, is that we're not rational. The second is really understanding the psychology of information, the psychology of the facts and the data. And so, you know, a lot of that orientation comes directly out of the environmental movement and environmental sciences and people who are out there measuring and tracking and immersed in the data. And so it makes sense, if that's what you do, to then present that and expect that that will then generate and mobilize a response. It just seems very, very common sense. But in fact, if people are exposed to information, this is kind of a broad statement here, but if we're exposed to information without the adequate context to process that information, and that can include a sense of support, you know, kind of emotional support. It can include clear direction as to what you can do about it. It can include the context, like the show just prior was talking about the incredible complexity of these contexts that we're working in around ecological health and integrity. Without that, the data and the information can simply trigger our anxiety and overwhelm. And then what do? We shut down.
I think a lot of our listeners, even who are on the side of believing climate change is real, know exactly what you're talking about. It's overwhelming.
Right. Right, exactly. And so it's not about not including the information and the facts and the data, but it's thinking about how we can communicate that as skillfully and compassionately and artfully as possible.
Well, you do a lot of consultation work with getting reframing and messaging and how to present or reframe these ideas. So do you have any suggestions for us, in fact, because we are environmental communicators. We're trying to, I think both Karen and I would say we're activists, and we want to engage people more in, for instance, like I was drawn to New York City in September to be on the streets. There's 400,000 people, but how do we get more people involved? We actually need a populist movement of the level commensurate with the problem.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So do you have any suggestions for us?
I do have thoughts. So I can't claim to know the answer for how to mobilize the entire planet, which I wish I did. But I have some thoughts about how to think about this. And one of the things I do when faced with that question is, what would a good psychotherapist do? And it's sort of that question is sort of intended to be a little provocative, because it's not that I'm suggesting we all go into therapy or that we need group therapy. But let's think about what a good psychotherapist does with a patient or a client in communicating some difficult realities. And a lot of people coming into therapy, for example, are there for because things are not working out. There's a breakdown of some kind. It can, you know, all kinds of factors going on. So number one, you know, a good psychotherapist, and I say good because, you know, there's some variation out there. There's the fundamental capacity of empathy, of the capacity to have empathy, the capacity to empathize with your audience, with the others. And I think this is something very hard for us to do in the environmental community, because we are so invested and feel so strongly and the stakes are so high. And these are issues that are not only important to us, but I would say are us. Like, there's no separation. It feels like this is my being, my soul is on the line here. And so it can be very hard to have that capacity to take a step back and consider what might the other person be experiencing and maybe feeling anxious about or feeling uncertain about or whatever might be going on. And so there's a tendency to want to jump in and say, you know, you need to do this. And if you don't, you obviously don't care about what's going on. So the empathy piece is really important. And how that translates as a communications practice. So a lot of what I do is in communications consulting. And you look at creative ways of weaving that in the form of acknowledgement. So let's say you have a campaign you're designing. So you may design into the campaign just a little bit of acknowledgement to say, yeah, we get it. We understand this is hard or this is kind of overwhelming. It doesn't have to be heavy. But that little bit of acknowledgement, what psychotherapists know, is it helps us manage our defenses, you know, our defense mechanisms against feeling anxiety or overwhelm or powerless, is that really that ability to say, I see you, I hear you, I understand. Now, I know we can't all do that in, you know, real time necessarily, but we can find ways to, how do you communicate in ways that do some of that? So those are just some kind of quick off-the-top thoughts.
What strikes me about that is the parallel to a principle we have in community organizing, which is called meeting people where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
Is that sort of, is that related
to about meeting
what you're
people
saying?
Where they're at. Yeah, and it sounds easier than it is. I think that it's actually one of the hardest things for us as humans to do. And that's why I think this kind of work requires, it's like inner work and outer work. We can't really engage within it without also taking stock in our own selves. For example, when I lead workshops, I often have people take a bit of an inventory. What are you really feeling about those you're trying to communicate with? And imagine those out there who are doing whatever. They're at the malls, they're on the freeways, they're in the oil companies. Imagine how you feel and really take stock of that, because when you go out and you're designing your communications, that's going to inform and influence the mood and the tone. And so that ability to check in with ourselves and have compassion for the anger and the frustration and the impatience is really important. It's not to say those aren't, you know, valid, but just to bring that awareness in, so then we again are more skillful at navigating our own frustration so it doesn't kind of leak into everything that we're doing.
We're talking with Dr. Renee Lertzman. She is the author of Environmental Melancholia, Psychological Dimensions of Engagement. And we're talking about how the science of psychology, including psychoanalysis and discussion of the unconscious, can inform our strategies for climate change communications everywhere from this radio show to what all our listeners are doing out in the big bad world. So what surprises me about what you just said is that first you said we know how to do empathy, that's built into us, and then I heard you say that it's hard for us to do it. So why is it hard for us to be empathetic? Why do we have to try so hard to do it?
Oh, I think it's one of those things where we have enormous innate capacity, but that it's a practice. And so it's the sort of thing where it's not like whether you can do it or not. But it requires ongoing, sort of like self-awareness, right? It's like an ongoing practice, and the more we're engaged in that, the easier it becomes. But I'm also thinking about the communities in which I've been working that are more environmentally oriented, climate-oriented, activist-oriented. And I'm not saying there's not a lot of introspection there, but I'm saying that the orientation, understandably, is very much about winning the battle, right? It's kind of a war mentality, and there's a place for war, absolutely. So I wouldn't want anyone to think I'm suggesting we all go out and, like, do kumbaya and, like, have group therapy. But I would also say that it's important, you know, given the war kind of, that there's a place where we are right now, I think, more than at any other time when we're being called on to become far more effective communicators than we've ever had to be. And that means having to become more insightful and knowledgeable about the human psyche than perhaps those of us in these fields have had to before. So,
This is KWMR. This is Post Carbon Radio. We're speaking with Dr. Renee Lertzman. And in about 10 or 15 minutes, we're going to open the phone lines for your questions and comments. And we're talking about climate communications today. Bing, I'm curious because I know that one of your other lines outside of the studio is that you teach Qigong and Tai Chi, right?
Correct.
And those are about being present.
Correct.
Does that give you any insight that relates to this conversation about people's personal practices and how that can bring us into more presence and self-awareness so that we can be empathetic?
Well, I'm also a student of Zen meditation, and I think that applies more to my what we're talking about, just being aware of what's going on in my mind and what my feelings are, you know, what's coming up for me. So I know what happens for me when I look at climate change. It's despair, grief over what we're losing. Mm-hmm. And I know that the work that we have to do is really face that grief in order to move through it. And to get that out of the way, what Joanna Macy calls psychic numbing. I think, can you elaborate a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So Joanna's work has been so important for me, and in a way kind of sparked a lot of this when I first came across her work in 86. And it was psychic numbing that I really picked up on. Basically where I'm at in relation to this, which is inspired by Joanna's work and others, is that our work is strengthened profoundly through our capacity to engage and relate with our grief and our loss. That it's very important for us to design and create context for us as individuals and especially groups to be with that, you know, and I was going to say process that, but again, it really depends on what the context is. You know, my colleague Rosemary Randall in the UK started a program called Carbon Conversations, and it's very British in the sense that you come for a cup of tea and you talk about reducing your footprint. It's not a lot of emotional, you know, expression as you might find in Marin, right? It's a very more reserved culture. But she found that just having people get together brought a lot up for folks, and they were able to move through it so much more quickly, having that container of a group, even a group working through a workbook. So it's again, it's not come and let's cathart and hang out, you know, in some workshop. That might work for some people. But I think that what you're raising is essential. And I think it really is needed in all levels of education, especially younger people coming into awareness around climate, need to be able to name and work through and engage with any kind of loss and grief that's there in order to basically, you know, be more effective. You know, the idea here, drawing on the psychodynamic model, is that when we're repressing or managing that, a lot of our energy is going to that. And so it's very paradoxical because in the environmental scene, sustainability, there's so much emphasis on being positive, being solutions oriented, being very, I call it rah-rah sustainability. It's like, yay, let's get people excited and let's go out into schools and create games and competitions. And it's completely short. It's
spiritual bypass?
Yeah, that's the word.
I've heard people saying that despair is not an option.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's a phobia that if we go there, we'll stay there. Mm-hmm. But what I think, this again is why I'm so inspired by psychotherapists, is they know from experience that's not the case usually, that when you create a space for that, we tend not to dwell there. We tend to move through it very quickly when we can name it and actually be with it. When we're actually running, you know, the term in psychoanalysis is a manic defense. When we're in flight, when we're running away from our own feelings of despair or fatalism, that's when we are arguably not as effective as we could be. You know, I wrote a piece for Climate Access last year, I think, called Making Friends with Fatalism. And again, I'm trying to be a bit provocative here because from a climate activist perspective, it would seem like completely counterproductive. Like, what are you talking about being fatalist? I'm saying having compassion for that part of us that can feel fatalist, and the paradox, and this is where the contemplative practice comes in, the Buddhist, the Zen, is that there's a paradox here. It's completely counterintuitive that when we allow for that it actually opens us up into being far more positive, healing, reparative than ever before.
I have a term that I use in my life. I call it the paradox of control. And I think it's something that probably underlies 12-step programs also, which is that when you sort of give up trying to control something is when it actually becomes more manageable. Is that somewhat analogous to what you're describing?
Yes, it is. To some degree. It's it's
that if we let go of trying to defend against these awful feelings of despair and negativity, that actually that's the only point through which we can make progress through
them. Right. That's exactly right. But I think we have to be very careful about what that means. So again, going back to the initial kind of template of having a container that's created through the psychotherapeutic interaction. To go into that, you need to feel safe. Mm-hmm. So we can't expect people to go into these places without creating safety. I think the creative challenge for us right now is how do we create that safety, even if it means not sitting in a room together necessarily. We may need that. I don't know. I'm kind of putting this out there as I think the creative edge and opportunity we have is, let's say we want to support people in all the ways we're talking about. How can we do that if we're not necessarily having that kind of, you know, in situ kind of interaction? Can we do it through how we communicate, through our messaging? Can we do it through a campaign? Can we do it through branding? You know, I think that's a question for us to look at.
I'd like to put in a plug for the Geography of Hope conference. I think it's a literary conference where writers are coming together to deal with the crisis we're facing. It's called Women in the Land. And I think a lot of the conference is going to deal with this: how do writers, what stories do they tell? How do we engage people to see the urgency of our situation?
Right.
And that's right here in Point Reyes Station, yes, March 13, 14, 15th, right?
Correct.
And that's a really important point around, one, the need for events like this that bring people together, and two, the role of the arts and the humanities is having an essential role in understanding human experience that's not just at that level you were talking about earlier of the data, but it's the feeling, the felt experience, and what is called affective in psychoanalytic world. Affect is really that feeling tone that you have that moves you in a particular direction. So there's it's really exciting to see these kinds of things coming together more in that way.
We're talking with Dr. Renee Lertzman about how insights from psychology and psychoanalysis in particular can help us be better climate change communicators and thus better activists. We're about to open our phone lines in about 5 minutes. I'm going to give you the phone numbers. Please don't call quite yet, but at 1:30 you can start calling 415-663-8492. Or 415-663-8317.
Well, we've talked about psychoanalytic work. That brings up the way the unconscious works. But we haven't talked about the actual mechanisms. I think somebody pointed out that it's analogous to people facing death. Kubler-Ross's, her thesis on how people face death. Can we talk about those mechanisms?
Sure.
Denial and so forth.
Yeah. So one of the reasons I'm so interested in psychoanalytic work, which I realize is not very in fashion. I mean, it's you know, you don't hear a lot of people talking about psychoanalysis these days, depending where you are. In the UK, where I did my training, it was more in the culture. But there's a very specific reason why, which is that I see psychoanalytic work as having a profoundly nuanced, rich, complex understanding precisely of unconscious processes that we are all talking about every day around climate psychology and response. And that's denial, that's projection, that's our tendency to create splitting, which is good, bad. It's like a very kind of binary way of thinking. You know, the polarization that we're seeing, that's all rich richly understood through the psychoanalytic lens. And the basic premise is that, you know, when we're feeling, when we're having anxiety, we do as humans engage in what are called defense mechanisms. And that's what we see playing out. And so therefore, it's really important for us to be, I think, tuned in and knowledgeable about the workings of specifically anxiety, how we do manage that. And I did want to say something about the grief in the morning. So various folks have drawn parallels with Kubler-Ross work. And what I find in a way more appropriate, perhaps, is the work of William Warden. And Rosemary Randall, again, in the UK, she wrote this beautiful paper on loss and identity and climate change. And she talks about Warden's model of mourning. And the main distinction about that is that it's not linear, right? It's not like you kind of go through the cycle. It's identified through these tasks of mourning and people working through these various tasks. And for a variety of reasons, she's found that to be a very astute way of looking at what happens when we are confronting the threat and the loss involved with climate change. And that's the other key piece that I think psychoanalytic work has to offer.
You're listening to KWMR. This is Post Carbon Radio. In a few minutes, we will open our phone lines. So it's now, the phones are open if you'd like to call with a question or comment for Dr. Lertzman. Our phone number is 415-663-8492 or 415-663-8317.
This is Post Carbon Radio, and our guest today is Dr. Renee Lertzman, who is an applied researcher, speaker, instructor, and strategic communication specialist, and resides in Inverness. And her work focuses on the psychological dimensions of climate and environmental engagement and communications.
And we have a call. Jennifer, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead with your question or comment.
But it is that I have the impression that what's exciting about what Renee is offering is that she seems much more hopeful about talking to people that aren't already active in or believers even in environmental change. So
she's right here. You can actually ask her straight up.
Okay. Renee?
Yes.
Is it the case that you are really talking very inclusively about working with people who aren't currently committed in any way to the environmental movement?
Yes. Yes. So that's actually a huge, huge emphasis of my work and was actually the focus of my doctoral research, which is called The Myth of Apathy, and specifically looking at the whole kind of range of population that we like to think of as apathetic and not engaged, not caring. And so I'm sort of on a mission to help us think about those folks a little bit differently in light of, well, it's not about a lack of care or concern, but how can we reframe the way we think about people as perhaps being overwhelmed or anxious or scared or in conflict, and how that itself has a radical influence on the way that we even conceptualize a campaign or a, you know, an engagement strategy or a branding message, because so much of the time we're used to, you know, speaking to people as if they do not care, and then we have to get them to care. And what I'm suggesting that you're picking up on is it's not like I'm saying everyone's walking around caring as much as everyone else, but how do we actually think about the way we communicate with folks who are not engaged?
Yeah, a big question for me is how do we talk to the people that are on the other side of the aisle in Congress, mm-hmm. who are denying that it's even happening, denying the science? Mm-hmm. Where do you begin?
Right. Well, that's a project that's actively being addressed mm-hmm. right now. There's a lot of work on the kind of crossing the partisan divide. And the focus of a lot of that research has been mainly around framing. So how do we frame these issues in ways that can be, I see it as giving people permission to engage, you know, through certain values that we know are really like national security or, you know, that kind of thing. My fantasy is that there, my fantasy is that there's a way to really get at what people are actually anxious about. And we can do that through doing interviews. And I've done that with interviewing Republicans around the country. And it's absolutely fascinating because you start to get at what's really going on is this, you know, there's anxiety. And it could be about a whole bunch of things. But once you get at that, it's like, it's powerful and it's like gold. Because then we can begin again to relate to, you know, making those connections and crossing those so-called divides.
I have a controversial question. Do you think that there is any segment of people or segment of belief holders who are sort of beyond communications hope? Like we're not going to reach them and we shouldn't spend our time trying?
Yeah, so that is the big question that's circulating right now. And I would say, I would sort of say yes and. I feel that actually in terms of energetic investment, that it does make sense in some cases to just, you know, not focus on trying to persuade and engage and convert those who are just so determined and so set in how they're feeling about things. But I feel like that in actuality, that's a very small number. Mm-hmm. I really do. I think it's smaller than we realize. I think, again, when people feel that they're being understood, they're being listened to, they're actually what they have to say and feel matters, which is why I think this goes back to this whole topic of engagement. You know, what is real engagement? You know, right now there's a lot of talk about engagement in the sustainability world. And I think there's, you know, a lot of times engagement really just means trying to get people to do what we want them to do.
Persuasion.
Yeah, it's like a euphemism for persuasion. And persuasion with some incentives and tricks mixed in, like let's give you a little prize. Or I think it's really patronizing, quite honestly. But actual engagement is about really allowing people to experience themselves as having some input, having some contribution. You know, it has to be real. There has to be an authenticity where what you say matters, and then ideally you're able to see it matter in some way or another.
Are there particular skill sets that people could actually look into acquiring to facilitate that, such as, for example, active listening? Or is that not really...
Totally.
Okay,
yeah.
Reflective listening.
Yeah, exactly.
And
so, yeah.
How and where would people find out how to do that?
Well, I think there's a real need for that. They can contact me and I can, you know, provide some input. But basically, you know, some of the tools and techniques that people are using that I have been impressed with include motivational interviewing. So Rosemary, again, Randall has incorporated motivational interviewing into the work she does. I'm thinking about a colleague of mine in Portland, Oregon, Kirsten Green, who runs Kogan Owens Green, and they do a lot of engagement work. And she happens to be a phenomenal facilitator. And, when, you know, it's at that level of facilitation where you just naturally incorporate these techniques of active listening. And but the what really matters is that they're providing, again, it's not just, you know, talking, right?
Yeah, and I just gave Renee the cutthroat, which means don't talk. But actually, what I was trying to say, I was going with what you were saying, and I meant, I thought you were saying we need to get below the neck,
yeah,
out of the brain and into the feelings in
exactly.
the body.
That's right, and not just giving lip service to engagement, but actually creating context where people have the opportunity to be part of something. Right.
Can regular people do that in their living room? Do we have to have a lot of training to know how to make that safe space, that container you talked about?
I think, well, that's a really good question. I would like to say yes, but I also feel that there's a place for, you know, learning some basic skills that have been developed that can be very, you know, supportive for process.
Okay. So I've heard us name three skills. Mm-hmm. I've heard active listening, I've heard reflective listening, and I've heard motivational interviewing. Mm-hmm. Are there other skills that people might want to Google just if they're going to try on their own to figure out, you know, what they need to know how to do? Other labels for the kinds of skills you're talking about? Or do you want to say more about what motivational interviewing is?
Well, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, the question that you raise is interesting because this is so emergent that, you know, there's not a lot that I can, you know, that's coming up immediately. It's like this is being innovated right now. So
who's working on it besides yourself?
quite a lot of people are working on it, actually. So, I mean, right now, what's really interesting is we're starting to see a lot more mention of conversation as a way of doing this work. And so, for example, Climate Access, it's a website that's a bit of a kind of a hub and a resource. You know, they had a webinar not long ago on conversation platforms. So what we're seeing is like the cafe, the conversation, the World Cafe, I'm working with, I'm hearing discussions in some activist communities around like how to support people having a talk, you know, so there's a basic recognition. There's something about human interaction and the ability to have good interaction and conversation that really is potentially the most powerful behavior change tool that we have. I'm in favor of skill development. So and so I'm, you know, what's very, compelling about motivational interviewing, which is a technique that's been developed in primarily in public health sectors, evidence-based, very rigorous. And motivational interviewing is a technique that helps people explore and resolve their ambivalence. And I haven't talked about ambivalence, actually, and ambivalence is really very important thing to understand in all of this area. So motivational interviewing as a technique to explore and resolve ambivalence is a way of drawing people out through inquiry, through, you know, active questioning, where people are in relation to a particular behavior. So in this case, it could be carbon, it could be, you know, a number of things. And in guiding and facilitating the interaction so that people are actually supported to come to their own alignment. But, you know, we tend to only know where we're ambivalent through interaction. We don't walk around being aware of our ambivalence. And the reason why ambivalence is so critical in climate psychology is because as a clinical term and a phenomenon, it literally means that we are capable of simultaneous investments, simultaneous desires and drives and wants and needs and
attachments.
And it's all can happen at the same time. So ambivalent doesn't mean kind of what we think of in a more colloquial sense of, whatever. That's not what it means here. It means we're literally pulled in different directions. And so what our task is to identify where the ambivalence is and then help address that and meet that.
So it doesn't mean I'm attached to being gray. It means I'm attached to both black and white.
That's right.
At the same time.
That's correct. And really, the goal here is to how can we help people work through and resolve the ambivalence for behavior change. So, you know, I'm deeply ambivalent about flying, right? Like I love to travel and, you know, I'm love to visit my friends in different parts of the world. And I am very deeply affected by what's happening with climate change and with particularly the risk to non-human beings really gets me. So one does not cancel the other, right? It doesn't mean I don't care enough about the beings who are threatened. It means that I'm a complex human being, as we all are.
So I'm going to propose something, and then we'll take a short break, and you can decide whether you want to do this, because I'm springing this on Renee right now without any warning. I'm wondering if you wanted to do a mock motivational interview around ambivalence around flying, which I have, as a model for what you're talking about. We're talking with Dr. Renee Lertzman, and we're talking about insights from psychology and psychoanalysis for climate communications. We do have 15 more minutes of the show, and we are taking calls at 415-663-8492 or 415-663-8317. So while we wait for calls, Renee, what do you think about that idea of doing a
roll
call?
I think it's an interesting idea. I'm up for it.
And actually, since I might be the one answering the phone, Bing, would you do a role play?
Sure.
Are we starting?
You're on.
Okay. Okay. All right. So let's set the scene here. So what a potential context might be for us. So
do you want to do flying? The flying one you just talked about?
Is that
sure.
One for you?
I know I'm ambivalent about that.
Okay.
Because I do travel to D.C. for a protest or New York City or to a climate negotiations. And I beat myself up over it, too, you know, because I know that it's not the thing to do. I'm contributing to the problem.
Right. Okay. So why don't we start by you're just telling me about the last time that you did fly?
New York City. I went there for a 2-day teach-in on techno-utopianism and the fate of the Earth, how technology will not save the planet. And I flew there. I was helping with a conference there. And I went there the two months before for the People's Climate March. So I've done my share of flying this year, and I went to Tennessee for a arts and crafts workshop. So I've done a lot of flying.
So tell me a bit more about how do you relate with your relationship with flying?
Well, I hope that what I'm doing on the other side of the ledger will offset my carbon footprint.
Are you convinced of that? Do you feel?
No. you never know what kind of contribution I am on. I'm one number on the street, so I don't know how much good I'm doing, but it makes me feel a bit good that I am doing something.
So it sounds like you're continuing to engage in the flying behavior in part to support yourself, right, as a being in staying engaged and doing this work, and at the same time you're aware that you're not sure quite what the impact is going to be. Have you considered ever putting some sort of a quota on your flying?
No, I haven't really thought about that, but I do try to limit it. I mean, I don't think I have a lot of superficial activities. I go for just vacation or something like that. But here's an interesting subject. Talk about ambivalence is I'm a meat eater. I don't eat much beef, but there's – I don't know if you know the DVD Cowspiracy about how the cows in our the flatulence, the methane is contributes 18% more than transportation carbon. And yet I still eat meat. And although I'm not a heavy beef eater, so there I'm kind of caught in that. And although I am trying to cut down on our meat in our diet.
Are you – would you say that you're aspiring to eat less meat?
Definitely.
Is that something that you're – sort of is on your radar?
Yes.
And how would you imagine that happening?
My wife and I are thinking about learning to cook more vegetarian.
And do you have a timeline around that? Like, have you considered setting like a date?
We talk about it. We need to probably, think about the timeline when we want to do it, because we could keep talking about it.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's a good one.
So I'm going to jump in because, Bing, I realize I totally put you on the spot in addition to Renee, and I want to offer myself as the next victim if you want to keep doing this, because I certainly have flying ambivalence, and we don't seem to be getting calls, so I'm happy to do that if you want to be let off the hook. I don't know if you want to keep doing that or if there's other stuff that you want to, you know, make sure that our audience hears. We have about 8 more minutes left in the show.
Okay. Well, I do, before we close, there's a couple things I would like to mention, but I wanted to just check in with Bing on kind of how that was or what your experience with that was.
Yeah, it's sort of really, I haven't expressed it, you know, so I think you're really getting at my feelings and allowing me to process it, I think.
I think the thing to emphasize about the style, I experience it as a gentle way of relating with people, and it's very hard to keep from wanting to direct things into a particular goal or outcome, right?
But he already had said he wanted to talk. He was willing to talk about flying.
Yes, that's right. And so one technique in motivational interviewing, for example, that can be used if that hasn't happened is, do I have your permission to talk about this topic with you? Is it okay with you? So you're basically getting permission before just jumping in on someone about whatever they might be doing. And asking permission is a way of enlisting that person's participation in the interaction.
And then they take down their defense because they've agreed to let you come through that door.
Exactly. It's pretty savvy. And it's respectful, right? So again, that's something we didn't need to do because it was already there. But that's one thing is, do I have your permission to talk with you about this? And other kind of phrases that might be used, there's the reflective listening. Did I understand this right? Help me understand. Or, you know, there's also the normalizing. So we can practice.
Okay.
We can do it. Okay. So I understand that flying is somewhat of an issue for you.
Yeah, I feel very ambivalent about it, just like Bing. I actually grew up on the East Coast, and so I fly back east once a year to see my mother. And even doing that, I feel pretty okay about it because she's my mother. And, I can count on both hands probably the number of times I'll see her if that's the only time I see her.
Right. So it feels,
But I'm aware that I'm leaving this huge trail of CO2 in the atmosphere behind me. We all of us on that plane are. And I, like Bing, I try to restrict my international travel most of the time to things that are related to a political project or a climate project. But I kind of feel sad about that because my husband wants to travel more and I don't see other friends and I'm not sure how to resolve even the conflict in my own relationship about am I being unfair to my spouse, saying I'm not going to just go because you feel like going.
Well, that's an extremely common conundrum that a lot of people are in. So you're not alone. You know, chances are there's far more people who are dealing with these kinds of issues than we realize, but we're not talking about it, which is one of the issues, is there's sort of a we're not yet at the point where we're openly talking with one another about these things, right?
And, you know, when I do talk about it, sometimes I feel like either I'm the downer or I'm being holier than thou or I'm just sort of, it feels like this Protestant restrictionism thing I'm just denialism.
Right.
You know, like, where's the balance between just saying, well, I'm going to personally hold myself back from doing A, B, or C versus I'm going to try to do something politically that will have an impact that's much greater than my own personal abstention. I guess sometimes I feel that even that gesture is very individualistic and I think it's abstemious is the word. And I wonder even whether that's the right investment for my emotional energy.
Right, Right, yeah. So that is that's makes complete sense. I mean, it's like that's sort of what we're thrown into in with these issues, which is why I believe that we're talking about a very unique kind of psychological situation and terrain that we're in, which is damned if you do and damned if you don't. It's really a double bind. You know, I mean, Gregory Bateson wrote about the double bind years ago, and I find myself thinking of it more and more. You know, we are literally in this double bind. So you, how can you win if you're either going to be a downer or come off as holier than thou, or, you know, what is the way through to resolve this? I mean, Have you had like kind of a fantasy of what it might look like if this were more easeful, if there was some more ease around this?
You mean for me personally? No, I don't think I have. No, I think I'm used to playing the role of the political conscience, which starts to sound holier than thou. And so although I don't relish that, I'm sort of like, oh, it's my burden to bear that I'm going to have to be the person who says this at the party or not. And if I don't say anything, then I feel like I'm complicit in letting people get away with stuff.
Right.
And I don't know how to be positive and yet, you know, stick to my principles.
Right.
Even in conversation with other people.
Right. Well, it sounds like you're getting close to that. So in motivational interviewing, for example, a question could be, would you consider committing to thinking through or imagining a way in which you actually were able to manage these communications, these interactions in a way that, that felt more kind of right for you? So it's like you're kind of like, you know, it would be a little weird for me to say that now because it's like, it's not clear what our context is, you know, but generally that kind of questioning, would you be willing to consider that? Would you consider committing to resolving that? Or what do you think about, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And my answer, I want to answer you because I feel like, and my answer would be yes. And I would want some help with figuring out some language around that, that I could use and some approaches that might be new and to actually sitting down and thinking through what do I actually say in those circumstances, either to other people or to myself in my own head and talking with someone, you know, who could give me a different approach.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that would be really valuable.
But I'd need the help.
Right. Right.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up in a bit. Renee, do you have any final words?
Well, this has been great. I've really enjoyed talking with you. Thank you. I think the final thing I would say is that I do believe that climate change issues occasions, it's really calling on us to create a new kind of psychology. And I would also just point out that right now the field is sort of exploding with different approaches, you know. So we've got kind of the more behavioral change. There's social norming. There's nudging. There's shifting. There's pushing and pulling. And it's can be kind of a lot for people to navigate through. And just to be mindful that there are different kind of psychological schools of thought. And I do believe that the psychotherapeutic or psychoanalytic, you know, area is an area that has so much to offer. And I think that there's people amongst us who have a lot to offer who may not know how to engage, meaning clinicians amongst us, for example. And so it's something to consider how we might work to involve more people with psychological training in the work we do, even though it sounds maybe out there for an environmental activist or, you know, but I think the time is now where we've come to that place. And it'd be very exciting to see how that could, you know, come into being, you know.
And if our listeners want to stay tuned to this emerging psychological, you know, practices that can help us in climate change communications, where, including your own website, would you recommend that people tune in to stay informed?
I would suggest staying in touch with me through my site. I'm actually about to come out with a new one.
And how do the people get on your...
It's just my name, ReneeLertzman.com.
How do you spell that?
ReneeLertzman .com. And then there's Twitter. You know, I'm Renee Lertzman on Twitter. There's LinkedIn. There's the Climate Psychology Alliance, which is based in the UK, which is just evolving. That's something worth checking out if you just Google Climate Psychology Alliance. So there are these kind of new, there's emerging networks coming about.
Well, thank you for joining us today on Post Carbon Radio.
Thank you.
Renee Lertzman, PhD. And thank you for listening to Post Carbon Radio. You can listen to all our archived Post Carbon Radio programs at wmpostcarbon.com.
Thank you.
I'm trying to spread the word about this immense issue, but I find it absurd why so many people are confused. Some people don't understand the weight of this problem. Act now before it gets out of hand, cause Earth is calling. I was 10 years old, exposed to it. The inconvenient truth really made me concerned how it was going to affect the youth. The temp is still rising from the pollution we produce. We need to start striving for a solution to reduce. When we burn fossil fuels like coal and gasoline, we're using dirty energies when we should be using clean. When we burn, we're adding to the greenhouse effect. CO2, CH4, and N2O collect in our atmosphere. They remain up there for years and years, absorbing sun rays that come near. But we need to persevere, cause this makes our planet's temp rise fast. So why can't we find a way to cut back on our greenhouse gas?
We have waited too long. Act now before the moment's gone. The situation's tough, but stay strong until we see the dawn.
The climate's on my mind.